somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation. Episode 23, Expert Opinion, with Professor Stephen Solomon. In the past two episodes, we've seen how freedom of speech gained ground in the American colonies in the 18th century, with key developments like the marked increase in newspapers and pamphlets, the huge influence of Cato's letters, and the Sanger case that practically ended criminal prosecutions for seditious libel. We also saw how the great bulwark of liberty, that is press freedom, became both an ideological and practical tool for the Patriot side when conflict broke out between Britain and its American colonists, and that Patriot propaganda played an important part in rallying opposition to British rule and fomenting the dissent that led to war and the Declaration of Independence. But with independence ensured, the new United States had to grapple with the question of how and to which extent those very freedoms that the Patriots had championed against the British should be applied when governing themselves. So today's episode will dive into the origins and early history of what many free speech proponents think of as the gold standard of constitutional free speech protections, the First Amendment. With me to shed light on the history of the First Amendment is none other than Stephen Solomon, who is the Marjorie Dean Professor at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at New York University, where he teaches First Amendment law. He's also the founding editor of First Amendment Watch, which is a great resource for news on all things free speech. Most importantly for this podcast, Stephen Solomon is the author of Revolutionary Dissent: How the Founding Generation Created the Freedom of Speech. Listeners of this show will know that Revolutionary Dissent has featured prominently in the previous episodes on free speech in 18th century America. And as a piece of shameless self-promotion, let me mention that both Steve and I would be part of a panel at an NYU Journalism School debate about free speech in the age of social media on May 8th in New York City. I'll link and tweet details when available. Steve, thank you so much for coming on the show. I've really looked forward to this episode.
Thanks so much for inviting me. This is going to be a wonderful opportunity to talk about the history of freedom of speech.
Before we dig into First Amendment history, tell me a bit about First Amendment Watch. What do you do, and how do those of us interested in the history and future of free speech, how can we benefit from your work?
Sure. So I started First Amendment Watch in October of 2017, and we have two main initiatives. The first is to provide a kind of one-stop shopping for news about the First Amendment and controversies that are going on. So anytime there's a controversy, at least in the United States, about free speech or free press, we cover it. We provide links to articles that are written about it, and we provide legal and historical analysis that we often write ourselves. And the second initiative, which started more recently, focuses on providing free educational material to primarily to colleges and universities, but also to a limited extent to high schools. And the exciting thing about that is that in college courses, professors often teach important cases and the principles that come out of it from those cases. And what we do is provide that along with a focus on how those principles play out in current conflicts, so students can study legal principles that the Supreme Court may have articulated 50 or 75 years ago, but they are discussing it and how it applies to conflicts today that might involve social media, or other things that they know in their world.
Excellent. What an important initiative. And I really urge all our listeners to check out First Amendment Watch. And also, just some shameless self-promotion. Both Steve and I will be on a panel at NYU's School of Journalism on May 8th in New York City, talking about hate speech on social media. So if you're in New York, please stop by and say hello. But now let's travel back in time. But before we get to the First Amendment itself, it might be useful to look at some of the developments that went before and inspired the Bill of Rights. And maybe we could start at the state level. And the most famous Declaration of Rights is probably Virginia's from 1776, drafted by George Mason. What can you tell us about the impetus behind this declaration and its influence?
So Virginia had just voted to separate from England and what is now independent. So the new state needed its own constitution and Bill of Rights. So it went ahead to do that in May of 1776. So, you know, before the Declaration of Independence was written and signed. So these were, in Virginia, these were men who were very well read in English legal history and well read in the Enlightenment philosophers. And George Mason took it upon himself at the Virginia Convention to draft a Declaration of Rights. And he drew from English constitutional documents, especially the English Bill of Rights of 1689. He drew from natural law, especially from John Locke, and from the colonial charters, the Virginia Charter, for example. And the Declaration of Rights protected the free exercise of religion, the rights of the accused, such as, you know, trial by jury, no excessive bail, and guaranteeing a speedy trial. And of course, it also protected freedom of the press. And in doing so, it used the actually introduced the principle that the press was the greatest bulwark of liberty and can never be restrained but by despotic governments. So the idea of this great bulwark of liberty went back to the idea that the press enabled people to discuss government, to discuss public affairs, and to criticize public officials when they wanted to. So this great bulwark of liberty was important to protect.
One thing I love about the statement, the great bulwark of liberty in the Virginia Declaration, is that it goes back to at least Cato's letters, number 15, which were ubiquitous, as you also show in your book, Revolutionary Dissent, in colonial America. And I think it was used in the Sanger case, was used in the conflict over the Stamp Act. So you see sort of a continuity, a red thread that becomes part of the Virginia Declaration.
Yes, and when we get we move on to the introduction of the amendments in 1789, we'll see that James Madison, who was at the Virginia Convention and worked with George Mason on the Declaration of Rights, introduced an amendment protecting freedom of the press and used the same words, greatest bulwark of liberty. So as you pointed out, it started before the Virginia Declaration of Rights and it would continue afterwards as well.
There's one interesting thing which I touched upon a little bit in the previous episode, I believe. George Mason is the principal drafter of the Virginia Declaration, and he includes a protection of religious tolerance, but Madison then expands it to freedom of religion, which I think is significant. I mean, freedom of religion is broader than mere tolerance.
Yes. So the Church of England was the established church in Virginia. And George Mason thought it would be a big advance to guarantee toleration of all religions. Young James Madison, probably 4 or 5 years out of Princeton, didn't like the phrasing toleration because it implied that there was a superior religion that just tolerated the others. But it also implied that toleration could end. So he used the phrase free exercise of religion. And that's what was adopted. And then Madison and the first federal Congress used free exercise of religion in the First Amendment. So that was a big, very significant change in the Virginia Declaration of Rights to go from toleration of religion to guaranteeing the free exercise of religion.
And as I understand it, Madison was partly moved because Baptists and Presbyterians, so religious dissenters, were basically saying, you know, we're protesting against taxation without representation of British, but why do we then have to contribute to an established religion? That doesn't make any sense. So that's a strong example, actually, of how an expanded freedom of speech was used to expand freedom of religion, whereas often the argument is made that freedom of religion is the precursor of freedom of speech.
Yeah, well, it also shows where these rights came from in a sense of what they were thinking about at the time. So Madison was at Princeton studying under John Witherspoon, who was a Protestant separatist, and Madison learned from Witherspoon about freedom of religion, the freedom to practice all the different things that one does in religion without punishment. Then he goes back to Virginia, and what he sees around him at that point are Baptist ministers being jailed and even physically attacked because they were practicing their ministry. And he, in fact, writes letters at that point. He's in his early 20s. He writes letters to some of his college buddies pointing out this terrible injustice. And then he has the opportunity a few years after that at the Virginia Convention to write free exercise into the Virginia Bill of Rights. And so there's a combination of Madison learning from the books and learning from a very powerful mentor, and also the personal experience of what he saw around him in Virginia when he returned.
The other very notable state declaration was that of Pennsylvania, which guarantees both freedom of the press and freedom of speech, which I also thought was quite noteworthy. Any insights on that?
Most of the protections in the state constitutions and bills of rights went to protection of freedom of the press, because that was the most powerful instrument that they had used against the British. Freedom of speech, of course, goes to talking, exchanging ideas, but it was the press that was the institutional means of spreading protest and publishing essays and publishing pamphlets, and it was also subject to seditious libel prosecutions. So, going way back, as you pointed out, into the early 1700s, the press was so important, and was also the subject of prosecutions with John Peter Zenger and others.
Yeah, I like that Pennsylvania becomes sort of the libertarian outlier, if you like, among the early independent states on free speech and the press, because during the days of William Penn, the limits on political speech were actually quite strict and people got whipped or seditious libel. So that really shows a change in perception and attitudes towards the idea of free speech.
Well, that's right. I mean, as you pointed out in an earlier podcast, most of the problems with political speech in the 17th century was speech, not press, because there weren't many presses in the colonies until around 1700. But there were more than 1,200 seditious libel prosecutions in the 1600s in the colonies, and that was primarily for speaking. Or perhaps writing something down, but it was mainly involved with speaking. Then you get into the 1700s and the protests against the royal governors and the protests against the British, and you had the newspapers and the printing presses that were publishing the essays and pamphlets. So the press becomes the printing press becomes so important.
All right, moving on from the states to the Articles of Confederation that goes before the actual Constitution. And that included a protection of speech and debate in Congress, but not from Congress, which I guess is modeled on the English Bill of Rights of 1689, which also protects free speech and debate in Parliament, but not British citizens from laws of Parliament. But what was the significance of this limited protection of free speech?
So freedom of speech starts in the protection of legislators. And it's in the context in England, of course, of the legislators being prosecuted or otherwise threatened by the English monarchy. And a parliament, in the English Bill of Rights of 1689, got for itself a protection for free speech and debate on the floor of parliament. And this was a major, major advance. And so you fast forward almost a century, about a century, to the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. And the Founding Fathers put in the body of the Constitution protection for speech and debate on the floor of the House and Senate to make sure that legislators were free to discuss the public's business, to criticize the president, and to be able to fully consider petitions and things like that might anger people. So this was the sort of the first advance in freedom of speech. And then, of course, the question became in a representative democracy, if the representatives of the people have protections of free speech and debate, why not the people themselves?
Yeah, we'll get back to that, because Madison writes pretty brilliantly this contrasting British constitution, if you like, if you can call it that, with the new American one. But during the Constitutional Convention, when it's decided that we need to move on from the Articles of Confederation because they don't provide the sufficient basis for the new United States, and then the subsequent debate over ratification, the issue of free speech was central, both because the pros and cons of ratification were vigorously debated among politicians and citizens in newspapers and the public sphere. There's one quote which I like from Francis Hopkinson, who wrote that, "Since the world began, I believe no question has ever been more repeatedly and strictly scrutinized or more fairly and freely argued than this proposed constitution." But not only was free speech practiced during the Constitutional Convention, the issue of if and how free speech was to be protected was also among the burning questions, and you had Federalists and Anti-Federalists standing on opposing sides. Can you tell us more about these different factions and what divided them, including on the need to protect freedom of speech?
Yeah, so these weren't political parties. The Federalists supported ratification, and the Anti-Federalists were opposed to it, and they squared off just as soon as the Constitutional Convention ended in September of 1787. And as you pointed out, this was probably the greatest debate in American history, a vigorous debate on political principle, which sometimes became vitriolic, sometimes very mean-spirited. Many of the most important political essays were written under pseudonyms. We can remember Cato and Sentinel, Brutus, the Federal Farmer, and of course the Federalist papers written by Madison and Hamilton and Jay under the name Publius. So the Anti-Federalists were opposed to the Constitution on a number of different for a number of different reasons. One was, and perhaps most important, was that the Constitution lacked a Bill of Rights, and this was very important to Anti-Federalists. They argued in the ratifying conventions all over, up and down the East Coast, about the lack of a Bill of Rights. They were also they also complained about too much power given to the federal government over such issues as taxation and the regulation of commerce and navigation rights. So those were the Anti-Federalists. The Federalists argued that Congress could only act through enumerated powers, and so it was very difficult for Congress to violate rights when it didn't have power over certain areas. So why worry about Congress violating freedom of speech, for example, or freedom of the press, when there was no enumerated power for Congress to do anything in those areas?
It's quite ironic that Madison who submitted the first draft Bill of Rights, was very skeptical of the concept of a Bill of Rights initially. He famously wrote that repeated violations of these parchment barriers have been committed by overbearing majorities in every state. So why was he so cynical towards the idea of a Bill of Rights?
Madison believed that people didn't have much to fear in terms of violation of their rights in a large republic. And that's because he said that in a large country, there'd be so many factions and so many interests that were at odds with each other that there was very little chance that one faction would achieve enough numbers, enough superiority to take control and violate the rights of minorities. But he saw the main threat coming from small political subdivisions like states, because there was not, in his mind, a great variety of factions and interests in smaller geographical areas like states. And so he thought it'd be easier for one faction to gain control and become an overbearing majority that would run roughshod over the rights of minorities. And his views in part came from his own experience in Virginia, because despite the existence of the Virginia Declaration of Rights protecting freedom of religion, a large enough majority almost formed in Virginia in the mid-1780s to impose a religious assessment to support religion. And this was defeated only by an outpouring of protests by religious minorities like Baptists and Presbyterians to defeat the religious assessment. But he was worried that in smaller subdivisions like states, Declaration of Rights or Bills of Rights, whatever you call them, were just parchment barriers that would just be kind of blown away in the face of these factions that could grow and take control and basically do whatever they want. So he thought that there were other ways of protecting rights. So for example, in the Constitutional Convention, he proposed that Congress have the power to essentially veto state laws. It was called a negative on state laws. And that was largely to protect individual rights and liberties. As I said before, the worry about overbearing majorities forming in states and violating rights, Congress would have the power to veto these kinds of legislative initiatives, and so protect the rights of people in the state. So he didn't think much of bills of rights, at least initially. He was more interested in institutional controls, like Congress having some oversight.
But this is one issue where his often ally Thomas Jefferson saw things quite differently, right? Jefferson was in favor of bills of rights.
Well, he was. And there's a remarkable exchange of letters between Jefferson and Madison on this issue. Shortly after the Constitutional Convention ended, Madison sent a copy of the new Constitution to Jefferson, who wrote back to him. And Jefferson gave Madison his feelings about some of the provisions. And he specifically mentioned the need to protect individual rights and liberties, freedom of the press, freedom of religion. He wanted safeguards against a standing army. And he had this one line that's quite memorable. He said, "A Bill of Rights is what the people are entitled to against every government on earth, and what no just government should refuse or rest on inference." Madison replied to him, and he argued that that a Bill of Rights was a parchment barrier and nothing more, as we mentioned before. And he argued that rights in a republic are reserved in the people, and they only gave powers to the government that they wanted to give. and you know, so the government couldn't legislate on matters of speech and press because there were no enumerated powers to do so. And also, he feared that a Declaration of Rights could actually backfire, because what if the rights not listed? Would they be regarded as unprotected forever? And then lastly, Jefferson writes back to Madison replying, and he said that, and this was very forward-looking on his part, he said that a Bill of Rights could be very effective because it would put a legal check in the hands of the judiciary. And of course, that's what happened with the Supreme Court assuming judicial review, and in the 20th century and now the 21st, with the power to review laws passed by Congress and the states that might violate freedom of speech and freedom of the press. So that was a very important and revealing exchange of letters between the two of them.
Great. Back to the debate between Federalists and Anti-Federalists, which obviously was one that the Federalists ended up winning. But they also had a huge advantage because the vast majority of newspapers at the time were Federalist, either sort of strongly partisan or Federalist leaning. But there were even some anti-Federalist newspapers that were hampered from free circulation. And there was a printing Federalist who ransacked the printing shop of a anti-Federalist publisher in New York. So here you actually see sort of a heckler's veto in the debate between Federalists and anti-Federalists.
Well, you see, you know, going all the way back to the colonial protests against the British, you do see, you know, some factions engaging in violence. Even the iconic Liberty Tree in Boston with the celebrations on August 14, 1765 against the Stamp Act that brought out, you know, a quarter or a third of the entire city of Boston to Liberty Tree. That was a peaceful protest, but then at the end, a faction of angry men broke off and did a lot of damage. So, yes, there's a history of peaceful protest, largely peaceful protest. There's a history of writing essays and pamphlets and newspaper articles that lay out arguments against the British. But there's also an ugly history of some people taking the law in their own hands and trying to intimidate people and to destroy property.
Yeah.
So both histories are there.
Yeah, you can just about understand why people like even Madison and Tom Paine, and perhaps not so surprisingly, given what happened during the Sedition Act, John Adams, who, when there was a war against the British, were incapable of tolerating sort of Tory or Loyalist printers. But I still think it's quite remarkable that you had these sentiments even after having won independence.
Yeah, well, I think what you're seeing is very early on is even with the understanding that freedom of speech and freedom of the press are very important values during times of intense stress, and the most intense stress comes during war or the lead up to war. Time and time again through American history, even with the First Amendment, you have the government, moving against dissenters during times of war, and you pointed out, you know, John Adams in the lead up to what was thought to be an upcoming war against France, passing the Sedition Act and the Alien Acts, and the laws and the jailing of protesters in World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War. So this goes on and on through American history. When in times of the most stress during wartime, sometimes the protections of free speech are not entirely upheld.
Despite Madison's initial opposition, it is Madison himself who, as a member of Congress, introduces the first Bill of Rights on June 8th, 1789, in what I found was quite a fantastic speech that appeals to unity and bipartisanship. It's a speech I think that the current political establishment in the U.S. could learn a lot from, because he very much appeals to the sensibilities of those he seeks to convince. But how close is Madison's draft to the final wording of what becomes the First Amendment?
Not very close at all. There were actually several amendments that he introduced. He introduces one that covers the freedom of religion, and that one was changed virtually every step in the legislative process. Madison said in that amendment that he introduced, the government could not establish a national religion. It also said that all the people would have full and equal rights of conscience. And in another amendment, he protected freedom of speech and freedom of the press. And he brought back that that very strong admonition about the freedom of the press was one of the great bulwarks of liberty. And, you know, the idea that he actually included a statement of principle in the enumeration of rights that the people held was really noteworthy. As it went through the House and Senate, there were a lot of changes. A representative named Samuel Livermore added Congress shall make no law to the amendment. The Senate combined the amendment on religion with the amendment on speech and press into one. And then the House approved 17 amendments. The Senate agreed to 12 of those, and they were sent out to the states for ratification. So Madison's initial amendments were boiled down to 12. There was a lot of change in language, a lot of debate, and then finally it was sent out to the states.
One of the interesting things that Madison mentions in his speech in 1789, and which he repeats in another famous speech in 1800, is he fleshes out differences between the British conception of free speech and the American one based on the new Constitution, which in Madison's view is rather substantial. How does he see this difference, and why is there this difference?
Well, in England, as he pointed out, sovereignty was in the government, and it was up to Parliament to protect the people from the king. In America, with the establishment of a Republican form of government, the people had sovereignty themselves, and with sovereignty and with the right to elect officials to represent them, the people had to be able to fully discuss public issues, and they had to be able to discuss them fully and freely without fear of retribution or legal action. So they needed a much more robust, much more expansive view of freedom of speech and freedom of the press, because it went along with representative democracy, and so it was really a different form of government that required a more expansive protection. So and so that's essentially the argument that he made, that with this new government, a form of government, the people must have the right to criticize. And any kind of threat of seditious libel prosecutions, for example, would inevitably chill speech. So people would steer far wide of the unlawful zone as they perceived it in order to avoid prosecution. And Madison thought that the people had to fully discuss things and not fear prosecution, because that would chill speech.
The basic difference is that in Britain, you only had a protection against pre-publication censorship, but none against post-publication punishments of seditious libel, for instance. Whereas Madison says, in America, we have both protection against pre-publication censorship and also post-publication.
Right. And so there was a lack of agreement on what the First Amendment meant. So in England, there were two forms of controlling speech. One was in the 13th century, Parliament passed a law, a seditious libel law that made it illegal to criticize the government. And then in the 1500s, they erected a system of licensing and censorship because they had to be able to control the printing press, which had just come along. And so licensing and censorship were pre-publication controls, what we call prior restraints today. And then seditious libel was the punishment that would occur after publication if people went beyond their kind of their assigned roles, or they criticize government when they shouldn't have. So when the licensing system expired, what was left in England was an idea of freedom of speech, whereby people could publish freely, but they were responsible for what they said. And when I say responsible for what they said, that was in the context of seditious libel prosecutions. And so you get to the First Amendment, the question of what did the freedom of speech and freedom of the press mean? What was actually protected? And there were some who said, well, all that was protected was what was protected before. That is, in English law, you could publish, but you were responsible for seditious libel prosecutions afterwards. And there were others like Madison who said, no, no, we have a new country here. We have sovereignty in the people. And as he put it, the people had to have the right of freely examining public characters and measures because this was the essence of self-governance.
It's quite, I think, incredible, at least to me as a non-expert, that many took the line that, in fact, the First Amendment meant nothing more than what followed under the British common law, or at least very little additional protections, given how, since the Sanger case, criminal prosecutions for seditious libels had been so odious to the American colonists who revolted, and statements that were clearly seditious libel under British common law standards were hailed as the exercise of free speech. And then many just turn around and say, well, now that we have our own government, basically, we don't believe that you should be free to criticize us.
Yes, well, there's a couple of ways of looking at this. Many legal commentators were looking at the fact that seditious libel was still on the books. It was still part of the law of England. It was part of the law of the colonies. And then after the revolution, it remained the law in America. But that was a law on the books. That took a while to change, as law does. But the other way of looking at freedom of speech and freedom of the press was what actually was going on. What was happening in the streets? What was happening in the newspapers? And at that level, the popular idea of freedom of speech and freedom of the press was that you could criticize. You could argue against public policy. You could criticize public officials. You could even criticize the king and parliament. And you could do so without responsibility under the law. And so on the ground, in the protests against England and the Acts of Parliament, the people felt that they had the right to protest, irregardless of seditious libel laws. And in fact, virtually every time a colonial jury was asked to consider a seditious libel prosecution, they refused to convict their neighbors. I mean, that goes back to the Zenger case that you mentioned before, 1735, with John Peter Zenger in New York, the publisher of a newspaper that was very critical of the British royal governor. And in the 1760s, of course, all the protests against the British, starting with the Liberty Tree in Boston, the protests against the various acts of Parliament, up until the American Revolution. So in the streets, in the newspapers, in the pamphlets, there was a very different understanding of what the people could say, what they could, how far their rights extended. And seditious libel, which was still on the books, was a dead letter in the streets and newspapers of America.
I always thought, you know, that the First Amendment signified that free speech and religion were given special significance as the first freedoms. But does that idea stand up to scrutiny?
No, I wish it did, because it is the First Amendment and it sounds like it belongs there. But actually, the Congress, the first federal Congress, sent 12 amendments out to the states for ratification. And only 10 of the 12 were ratified. Now, today's First Amendment was originally listed as the Third Amendment. Amendments number 1 and 2 were not ratified, so all the others, 3 through 12, moved up. And so number 3, which was freedom of speech, freedom of the press, religious freedom, moved from number 3 to number 1. So that's how it became the First Amendment.
All right. The wording of the First Amendment applies to Congress, but Madison also envisaged a constitutional protection against state restrictions on free speech. Why was that defeated?
In the first federal Congress, Madison was very concerned about the violation of individual rights and liberties by the states, especially freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and religion. And so he thought that the most important amendment among those that he proposed was one that would guarantee the protection of those rights against state legislation. As we know, the Bill of Rights only applied as limitations on the federal government, and Madison wanted to this one amendment to apply to the states. Because he thought that those liberties were so important to protect against state legislators. But that that did not pass the House and Senate. Actually, it passed the House, but not the Senate. And so it was not among the 12 that was sent out to the states for ratification. And Madison was very disappointed by that. He thought that this was the most important amendment of all, because he thought that the greatest dangers to individual rights and liberties came from the states rather than the federal government. But Madison's missing amendment, as some people call it, eventually bore fruit as the 14th Amendment to the Constitution in 1868, which over a period of time applied virtually every provision of the Bill of Rights to the states.
Yeah, and also I guess Madison saw, as I understand it at least, an important role for the courts as guardians of the First Amendment, and the Supreme Court would come to interpret the First Amendment as pertaining to the state. So in that sense, you could say that with time, Madison snuck in his defeated proposal.
Well, in many ways, Madison, his view won out in the end in terms of applying the provisions of the Bill of Rights to the states. And the idea that eventually the courts would protect people, that was an idea that was presented to Madison by Jefferson in that famous letter. But Madison's view of popular sovereignty and the need of people to have the freedom to criticize their representatives, that idea. Was adopted by the Supreme Court in 1964 in the New York Times versus Sullivan case, which said that the central value of the First Amendment is uninhibited, robust, and wide open speech, which may involve very strong attacks on government and government officials. So this was an explicit adoption of by the Supreme Court of Madison's view in 1800 of a more expanded meaning to the First Amendment and the importance of freedom of speech and freedom of the press in a democracy.
Now, there are many different justifications for free speech, ranging from individual autonomy to political pluralism, popular sovereignty, and the marketplace of ideas. What would you say was the most important justification of the First Amendment when drafted and ratified?
I think, you know, the marketplace of ideas was talked about a lot, but I think this, the most important single value behind freedom of speech and freedom of the press was self-governance, as we've talked about, the right of a free people who elect their own representatives to criticize those representatives. And, you know, the idea that Madison said of freely examining public characters and measures as being the essential right in a democracy. And he actually said that this expansive idea of freedom of speech and freedom of the press was the only effectual guardian of every other right. So that's how important he thought it it was.
Yeah, and he has a quote, Madison, in the mid-1790s, I think, where he says, "The censorial power is in the people over the government and not in the government over the people," which I guess also expresses that idea.
Yes, very much so. And, you know, again, he's coming back to the idea that, you know, it's the people who have the power here, not the representatives. The representatives who they elect are actually the servants of the people. And in order to keep it so, one has to be able to basically critique what the representatives are doing.
Okay, today the First Amendment, as you alluded to, has been very much expanded and provides a very strong protection of free speech, covering, in some instances, crush videos of animal cruelty, commercial speech, and so on, and also what we today would call hate speech. Would Madison and the rest have recognized their First Amendment ideals in the Supreme Court case law developed over the past 6 or 7 decades, you think?
I think so. You know, again, I think their main concern back then was political speech, because that's they were fighting the battles against the British, and they were you know, engaged in the greatest debate in American history, which was around the ratification of the Constitution. So what they knew was mainly political speech, but of course the Supreme Court has protected political speech as, you know, continuing to be a central value of the First Amendment, but it's gone much beyond that. And so today we refer often to the protections as going to the freedom of expression, because it goes way beyond political speech and includes, as you said, many other areas such as artistic speech and many other things that may not have been a concern to Madison and Jefferson and the others. But there are many ways to express oneself. And I think they would have been pleased that, you know, the First Amendment protects artistic expression, for example, because there's a value in developing one's talents and intellect. All of that goes not only to the development of an individual, but the contributions that an individual makes to society. And so this larger conception of the First Amendment is to the benefit of individuals and society. I think they would have been pleased by that.
In the digital era, most of public debate now takes place or is shared on privately owned platforms like Twitter and Facebook, whose content standards are not subject to the First Amendment. And increasingly, these tech companies adopt what you might term Europeanized standards on hate speech and so on that originate in Brussels or Berlin rather than Washington. So you might say that Americans are subject to moderation without representation. What would a Madison or Jefferson say to this paradox, and does it render the First Amendment ultimately irrelevant today?
I think there would be a very strong concern that Americans would be unable to you know, read and listen to important information because it was regulated by other societies and eliminated.
But what would Madison or Jefferson, how would they solve this paradox with social media companies, you think?
Oh, it's so hard to, you know, place Madison and Jefferson in the 21st century with the internet and the kind of regulation we're talking about today. I think we can say for sure that they would be very strong in making sure that, you know, American interpretation of the First Amendment remained very strong and was protected by the courts. And as far as the other, other countries go, it's really hard to tell because it's kind of dangerous to try to place 18th century legal thought into the 21st century with such vastly different technology and the kinds of problems that brings about.
Steve, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much. And I look forward to meeting you again in New York very soon next month.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure to participate in your podcast.